Memory is interesting. This morning, I was eating celery because I did not want to forget it. So I ate some celery to remember. Sometimes what we remember surprises us. We remember what is significant, not necessarily what we think is significant, if you know what I'm saying. You know what I mean? Memories can play tricks too. A couple years ago, we went camping. And Benjamin was younger then, and he was running around and took off and just really happy to have his freedom. And he stepped in a cow patty and wiped out all over that. And we talk about that story. That's like a story that we talk about. And the kids go, "You weren't even there." I'm like, "Yes, I was there." So we have these things where I remember things that, and I wasn't even there. You guys know what I'm talking about? The idea of Passover or Seder, through the rituals that are prescribed in Scripture, we learn a story that shapes identity, that story that helps us understand who we are and our place in the world. And today we're looking at one component of the Passover, karpos, as opposed to how Eric said it, karpos. Karpos is one of the traditional rituals in the Passover. It refers to the vegetable, usually parsley, but when you upgrade it, celery, that is dipped in salt water and eaten. And it is done to remember the salty tears that people shed when they were oppressed and in slavery and bondage. It is about remembering. I've got a few more. There we go.
It's also good for your kidneys.
Who else? Come on, three more. Some churches handle lattes. We do parsley and celery. Andrea?
I'm actually allergic to celery.
Oh, no. Who's got an EpiPen? You want one? There we go. Okay, chew on that as we engage in this. What brings you back? All I hear now is chewing. What sort of things jog your memory? You know, it is just a piece of celery. But it's supposed to help us remember slavery and oppression. And at Passover or Seder, as we will be having a meal together in a few months, the karpos brings us back to the events of the Exodus, the bitterness of slavery. Anyone want this one? Today we're looking at Exodus chapter 1, verses 11 to 14. And this is where we find ourselves. The Israelites have been in Egypt for generations. They have been there ever since Joseph and his brothers went there and he became a revered leader in Egypt. And they all came to live with him. But now there is a new Pharaoh, and he doesn't seem to know anything about Joseph. He feels threatened by the Israelites because they are flourishing. Their numbers keep increasing. Their numbers are getting big, and it makes them uncomfortable. They feel afraid. So he decides to do something about it, and we find that in Exodus chapter 1, verses 11 to 14. And as I read this, I want you to imagine that you are there in slavery, daily struggling. Put yourself into the story. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. What's clear is that the Egyptians are full of fear. fear of the Israelites. They are a problem. They're getting too powerful. So they try to turn this problem into opportunity, and they turn them into slaves. And they are treated with hatred and vile. They were merciless. They afflicted them with heavy labor. They tried to break them as a people. The Israelites' lives were bitter. There was nothing of hope in them. They were being broken. One of the things, though, that comes to mind in the Exodus story is not just slavery, but also freedom. The theme of freedom in Exodus seems so obvious. We learn that God is a God who has come to set captives free. He is a God of freedom. That is what Jesus is all about. He's about freedom. This is what he proclaimed in the synagogue in Luke chapter 4, verse 18. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom to the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free. So we can look at the Passover story and we can see the theme of freedom in it. God is a God who is about freedom. And if we go a step further, we could say Jesus sets us free to give freedom to others. Freedom is a gift that needs to be passed on. We've been freed for freedom. You know, the Exodus saga is one of the most beloved scripture passages used by Christians all around the world who are yearning for justice, who live in poverty and slavery and oppression. They identify strongly with the story of the Exodus. It is personal because they live in that kind of oppression. What is our relationship to this story? I even wonder who we are called to identify with in this story, in this Passover story. We have a choice of who we can identify with. And I believe the natural tendency is for us to identify with the Israelites. Of course. That is the object of the Passover, to enter into the story, to understand what it means to be a people who are oppressed, to understand the salty tears of bitterness. It is natural that we should identify with the Israelites when we read this text. It is good to identify with the Israelites because they were freed. And we understand that we modern day believers have been freed. But freed for freedom? It's really interesting, depending who you are, depending on your demographic, depending on how wealthy you are, where you live, even your skin color, this story can be identified with differently. When people in slavery or oppression read it, they read it as a text that shows the trajectory of the gospel is to pronounce freedom and it is to set people free literally. That people need to be released from bondage, poverty, oppression, literally. But people in power, largely the Western church, have read this differently. They have read it from a distance and have read it on one level as a historical story. Yes, a story about the Israelites being freed. But a curious thing happens with this group of people. They, or could I say we, maybe, completely miss or omit or ignore any imperative or implication that our God is a God who is concerned about setting people free, literally, from slavery, from oppression, from poverty. It's been read historically as a story about Israel being set free, but without any implication for Christian ethic, without any call to action over slavery, poverty, oppression, and setting people free. I know it might be easy to say, no way, that's not us. But I have met personally and talked with many Christians who don't believe that starving people and feeding them, and I mean literally starving people, was a priority. They said they should be more concerned about converting those starving people than giving them food. This thinking represents a Christianity that is much different from what I think the gospel says. Earlier, I raised a question about who we identify with in this passage. Surely we identify with the people who were freed, the Israelites? Surely not the Egyptians. But I invite you to consider for a few moments this text from a different perspective. From the perspective of the taskmaster, the afflictor, the oppressor. I'm asking you to do this because I think it is a valid way for us to appreciate freedom, that gift of freedom, and what it means to pass that gift on to others, because we have been called to freedom for freedom. We are called to offer it to others. Throughout history, Christian churches and theologians have unfortunately accepted slavery as God's will for some people, especially when those people have not been Europeans. This is recent history. It is a historical fact. Most of them have used the Bible as their chief reason for the acceptance of slavery and their promotion of it. Because the Bible doesn't outright condemn slavery. You can't find a passage that says slavery is bad. Augustine of Hippo, otherwise known as St. Augustine, one of our great church fathers, said that slavery was because of the sin of the slaves. He was very influential. His ideas affected the church's understanding of slaves for centuries. Well, we think, we're Protestants. It wasn't us. The Protestant Reformation happened during the same time as the European slave trade in Africa. Slavery wasn't even near being on the agenda. As millions of Africans were stolen from their homeland, Catholic and Protestant theologians debated mass and hardly referred to it in their theological and ethical reflections. And of the few who did, most did not oppose the idea that people could be property, especially people of colors other than white. And from the perspective of the European theologians, it was God's will that whites rule over blacks, because the former were racially superior. In North America, white churches and their theologians were well known for their support of slavery as the will of God. And at first, slave masters didn't want missionaries talking to the slaves because they feared that the talk of freedom would lead them to claim freedom. But then the theologians taught that Christian slaves made better slaves because they were supposed to be obedient and docile, as the Bible says. They taught slaves that they should obey their masters because it is God's will. To disobey the master, therefore, was to disobey God. So with the exception of the Quakers, no denominational churches took a stand against slavery. In fact, most churches owned slaves. The black victims of slavery did not accept the white preacher's view of the gospel. They preached that God wanted their freedom, not their slavery. They pointed to the Exodus story of the Israelites being slaves in Egypt. The prophets stand for justice and Jesus' identification with the poor, dying on the cross like them. And lest we keep this text at a distance, here in Canada, we settled this great nation under the guidance of the doctrine of discovery. Christians just a little while ago, based on their faith, believed that they had a right, the obligation, to claim land they discovered for Christian monarchs. If it was not inhabited by Christians, it was discoverable. If the pagan inhabitants could be converted, they would be spared. If not, they could be enslaved or killed. And for us here in Canada, that was the foundational assumption for settling this nation. No one really saw it. It was just an assumption, the water that we swam in. The superiority of European culture melded with Christianity was obvious to them. All of this to us, I know, is sickening and disgusting. It doesn't fit with the Jesus we know. It doesn't fit with the gospel we know. But I ask again, who do we identify with when we remember the Exodus? Maybe we could identify with both. In some ways, at least, we can be aware that recent Christian tradition, people who believed in Jesus, who were sincere in their faith, were the oppressors. We still struggle with this idea of keeping the gospel partitioned, as if you can separate the actions of faith and the actions of love and mercy from personal salvation. We still have this debate. Should we be feeding the starving or converting the starving? Should we offer a glass of water or offer a tract? I find it disturbing that we can so easily miss the message of Exodus, the message of the Passover and Seder, the message of Jesus. I find it disturbing that we can so easily miss God's heart for the oppressed, for the slaves. How did Christians miss the theme of freedom for so many years? We are still struggling with it. We still miss it. I would almost say we want to. Our God is a God of freedom. He came to set the captives free. And we can choose to understand this in a purely spiritual way. But if we do, it leads us down a dangerous road. It leads us to reading the Exodus as a story with no imperative, no direction, no directive to be a people who literally set captives free. The Exodus to those who are oppressed is a passage of hope. It says that the God that we worship is for the downcast, for the oppressed, for the abused, for the afflicted. And doesn't this reading jive with the teachings of Jesus? Wasn't Jesus the one who spoke against the religious establishment? Who spoke against systems of oppression and abuse? Who pronounced the poor and the broken blessed? It was indeed. But for almost 500 years, we missed that as the church. How could this happen? Are we not all oppressed in some way? Is this not good news on several levels? Not just for our souls, which I affirm, but also for those of us, all of us, who struggle from real oppression every day, who see real oppression every day. God's people are freed for freedom. We are called to be a people who release others from oppression. We can't ignore the imperative in this. As God is the one who sets people free, so shall we be a people who set people free. If we ignore it, if we read it just as a story with no imperative, the type of Christianity that emerges is a radically personalized Christianity. It's one which simply emphasizes personal salvation and personal relationships as all that matters. And this is a product of another time, of the Enlightenment and modernity. in which we see the emergence of the individual as the center of thinking. This was an important move. It was lost through history and was not valued. However, Christianity became a thing of me and Jesus. Last week, we talked about the communion meal. We looked at the Passover cup and the theme of Kiddush, the blessing. It is fascinating how many issues emerge around food and eating and the basics of human existence. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is probably one of the most recognized passages in the Bible about communion. Especially verse 27. So then, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of sinning against the body and blood of the Lord. This is how we tend to read this text. We read it out of context and with the understanding that it is all about the individual and their individual sin. So we will ponder whether we have had a bad thought or done some personal sin. But Paul was writing about the issue of community. It is about rich Christians living high and ignoring the people they worship with. It was about the agape meal that we talked about last week, the way communion used to look, a big meal at a church gathering, eating a long meal together with the bread broken first and then the wine at the end of the meal. This is what the communion meal used to look like. And it would be one room being catered by a 5-star restaurant with the best food, lots of meat, delicious delicacies, little sandwiches with no crust, and poutine in huge quantities with expensive wine, desserts, creme brulee, you name it. In the other room were the poor Christians. They basically had nothing. Some stale bread from the food bank, maybe a can of beans, and a little bit of vinegar. This is how they were engaging in communion. And Paul said that this is so wrong. You cannot say that you were a Christian and ignore the plight of your brothers and sisters. If you do, you really don't get it. It was very specific. You are not caring for the poor. You are not loving. You are violating the basics of Christianity when you have so much and those around you have so little. You were freed for freedom, to live in freedom and be free to others. And I want to tell you, we have too many Christians and not enough disciples. We have too many people who are born again who don't follow Jesus' call. And too many people who are saved from heaven and just want to walk away from earth. Jesus came to set the captives free. And when we follow Jesus, there is always a responsibility and a heart for the oppressed and the lost and suffering. Jesus calls his disciples to follow him. They left their nets and everything behind and became his disciples. They left everything to follow him and devote their life to this vast explosion of love that is the Jesus story. We have been freed to give and proclaim freedom. To remember, to truly remember the Passover, to truly remember the tears of bitterness, of oppression. We have to understand that oppression and slavery. So we remember the Passover. We remember the slavery in Egypt. We remember the slavery in North America. We remember the story of residential schools. On a personal level, we need to remember, what have we been freed from? What do you remember? Maybe we're still in need of freedom. Maybe we're still in bondage, physical or spiritual, it doesn't matter. Because as God's people here, we, the ones who have experienced freedom, respond to that freedom by noticing the oppression of others by offering freedom to others. That's the imperative of the Exodus story. Our God is a God who sets people free. Galatians 5:1 says, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by the yoke of slavery." It is for freedom that we have been set free. We are freed for freedom. Remember. Remember. I call the team up. Just ask you to remember what you're freed for.